Raven asked.
Wastelands, Fire said.
If not for these wastelands, our eastern foes might have invaded us long ago. Fatter's armies, too.
Perhaps.
But is this land really worth winning? Day by day, Raven's sister was becoming a stranger to her.
How can you say that? This is our home.
Fire shook her head.
No. You are my home. Whisper. Marta was my home. Home is not a place. Home is your family.
Raven had never heard her sister talk like this, so passionately about family.
You surprise me, she said.
Fire laughed lightly.
I know you think I have no heart, sister. I know you think I'm the edge of a blade, made for only one thing.
It was Raven's turn to laugh.
You know my mind better than I do. Yes, I have always wanted to be Empress, but not for the power. Not to control the most powerful army in the south. No. I wanted it so you didn't have to wear the dragon crown, sister. I was born with the fire mark, not you. It's my responsibility. My burden to bear. Mine alone.
Raven had no idea her sister felt this way.
She'd hidden her heart well behind a veil of bravado and strength. All these years. I don't know what to say. Why didn't you tell me this before?
Fire squinted into the distance, as if searching for the answer amongst the dunes.
I didn't want your pity. I needed you to think me brash, overconfident. I wanted you to bring your best into the arena, so you would judge me worthy of leading.
Raven shook her head.
I always knew you were worthy. I always knew you were strong. But I withheld love so many times. I gave it to Whisper instead, because I thought she needed it more.
Yes, Fire said.
That's what I wanted.
Raven rested her hand on her sister's arm, surprised that her typically fiery skin was quite cool to the touch.
You are not alone. I will stand by your side for whatever comes.
Fire reached across her body and rested her hand atop Raven's.
Thank you. I could not ask for a braver ally.
Raven nodded. She gestured to the dunes.
We may not reach Kesh by nightfall. 4 days is the estimate for one rider. We have many on foot.
We must, Fire said.
We will. Come on. The day has wings.
Raising her sword in the air, flames danced from her fingers and up the edge of the blade, signalling the start to the day's march. Raven watched her sister ride down the hill. Strangely, the heat of the morning seemed to sizzle around her, making her form fuzzy around the edges, until she faded into a fiery smudge against the sand. Almost ghost-like. 23. The Southern Empire, southeast of the Bloody Canyons. Jai-Jeru. If the night prior was sheathed in moonlight, the next eve was speckled with starlight. It was almost magical, the harsh terrain. Thousands of galanzialas lit the landscape. The abundant desert plant hid from the sun during the day, pulling itself into a crustacean-like brown shell that soaked up the light, turning it into food. At night, its shell opened and dozens of tendrils climbed toward the sky, glowing purple. It was between these beautiful night plants that Jai and the Black Tears now led his people. Jig and the other children ran from plant to plant excitedly, collecting glowing leaves. Jai could tell the adults were equally awed by nature's display, but held back. Before they'd gone too far, Jai stopped them. Sonika raised an eyebrow, but said nothing, waiting to see what he would do. He raised his voice so enough could hear him to pass his message back through the throng.
As you know, we are marching to the wall. There, we hope to escape to the west, where we can finally be free.
Murmurs of excitement rippled through the crowd, but Jai silenced them with a hand in the air.
However, the way is more dangerous than you can imagine. I will not lie to you. Even if we make it through the mountains, we will face sword and arrow as we cross to the Southron gates. Many will die, sacrificing themselves so some of us can make it. I cannot promise you safety.
It sounds like suicide, someone called out.
It's not, Jai said, but it's close enough. We hope our unexpected approach will be enough to surprise Hoza's soldiers, but that will not prevent bloodshed.
What are you saying?
Someone else asked.
That we should turn back?
Defiance coursed through the throng. No, Jai said. I'm only saying you have a choice. You can hide in the Black Rocks, or you can attempt to find a way across the Burning Sea on a ship. Or, if you go back to Fenrir of your own will, the Emperor may see fit to forgive, to welcome you back into his service.
Into slavery, you mean?
Jai nodded. Yes, into slavery. But at least you will be alive. I cannot necessarily offer you the same.
Slavery is the same as death,
someone shouted. Murmurs of agreement rose up. Jai nodded again. If any choose to turn back, let them decide now. There may not be another opportunity. Heads swiveled, looking at each other. None moved back. In fact, most took a step forward.
We're with you, someone said.
Then let us march to freedom, Jai said, offering the three-fingered salute. His people returned it, thousands of hands raised in the dark, lit by moonlight and galanzialas. Satisfied, he turned back toward the desert. Feet shuffled behind him. Nice speech, Sonika said. Thanks, Jai said uncertainly, not sure if he was being mocked or complimented. I am no master.
You don't have to keep saying that.
I know. I just want them to have a choice. They should always have a choice.
And that's what makes you a great leader, Sonika said.
Because they follow you of their own free will. Just like my tears. As they walked under the protection of darkness, Jai scanned ahead, his eyes adjusting quickly to the murky evening. To the north were the towers of red rocks that surrounded the bloody canyons. It was toward those bloody spires that they now headed, as quickly as they could, for they were naked and unprotected on the dustlands, with Hoza's stronghold in the square canyons of Fenrir only a day's hard ride away to the northwest, hidden somewhere beneath the surface of the desert. To Jai's surprise, he longed to return to the maze-like cauldron of the Black Rocks. At least there they were hidden from Hoza's soldiers. And yet, the further they journeyed across the dustlands, the greater his hope grew. If they could just get to the Red Rocks, they'd have a real chance, however slim. Nearby, Axa walked alone, his head down, his back bent. Already he was looking more like a slave than a master. Several bandages hung from his chest, arms and face like peeling flesh. After what happened a night before, when Joaquin ripped the jewels from his skin, Jai bandaged the man up. Now he kept an eye on Axa, just in case Joaquin tried anything else. In one hand, Axa held his mirror, his only remaining possession. Jai turned his attention away from his former mind master when Sonika Vade pulled back from the head of the throng to speak to him. Your people are strong. They move quickly, even the elderly and children. How is this thing possible? How are they not broken?
I trained them. Not only did their strength help them mine more diamonds, which satisfied the Emperor, but I wanted them to be ready for, well, for this.
Sonika shook her head.
You are unusual. Most masters break their slaves. You strengthen them.
Yes, and I prefer Fen Lu to Fen Ru, and I lived and ate with my people, and I helped them mine, and
I get your point. I'll stop asking.
Jai took a deep breath. Sorry. I'm overprotective sometimes.
It's fine. I understand.
Also, the day of rest did them well. After their long march through the Black Rocks, they'd lounged and slept the heat of the day away, sticking to the shade and drinking plenty of water. No one had complained about waiting for the sun to go down before leaving.
Not only would it be cooler, but the darkness would mask them better than anything else as they travelled across the plains. And, yes, I worked them hard in the mines to sate the slave king's lust for diamonds, but I treated them as well as I could. A free person toils far better than a slave.
"How did you accomplish this?"
Sonica asked.
"When your people have escaped, Fanes, I will return to the south and use the information to repeat your work."
"You would return?" All Jai had ever wanted was to leave the south with his people, never to look back.
"There are too many others who need us." Jai felt selfish. He rarely thought of those slaves toiling in the other mines, or even in the cities.
He was too focused on those slaves he felt he could help. The others faded into the background, grey figures that vanished like mist, almost ghost-like. "They are ghosts," he thought. "We all are."
"You are a good person," Jai said.
"So are you," Chanti said, pulling up on his other side, her cart rattling behind her.
Though Jai walked, their horses moved slow enough to stay with him. His heart did a quick flip at the sight of her, especially after the moment they'd shared high on the cliffs. He didn't know how to respond to such a compliment, especially when he wasn't certain it was deserved.
"I am just one man."
"Well, I didn't expect you to be two men," Chanti said, raising a light eyebrow.
A smile played tug-of-war with her lips. Laughing, Sonica dug her heels into her horse and galloped ahead to convene with the rest of her warriors. Chanti, however, stayed behind with Jai. Jai watched the rebel leader go.
"What's her story?" he asked.
"Sonica's? She doesn't talk about her past much."
"But you've been with her for a while now, right? You must know something."
"She had a brother once," Chanti said.
"He died?"
"I don't think so. They were separated somehow. She mentioned him once in passing, but refuses to say anything else. I think it hurts too much. I think they started all this together, but I'm not certain."
"Oh."
"You seem different today," she said.
"Like the door you opened last night has been shut and barred with iron."
"I have always been a closed door," Jai wanted to say.
At least until he spoke with her last night. And yet he'd still held so much back. He'd only just met her. Why should he share so much of himself with her?
"Things break when left unprotected," he said.
"People included. Sometimes a bone must be broken and then healed in order to grow stronger."
Jai raised both eyebrows.
"Is that true?"
"Honestly?" Chanti said, laughing. "I don't rightly know. I heard the saying once and it stuck."
Jai chuckled back. He felt like he'd already been broken too many times. Once more, and he wouldn't be able to heal again. So besides memorizing nonsensical old sayings and blowing things up with fire root powder, do you have any other hidden talents I should know about?
"Rotsoff," she exclaimed.
"What?"
"It's a common curse word used by the people of Anatoly."
Jai frowned.
"First, I don't even know where Anatoly is, and second, why are you telling me this?"
"Anatoly is a small island off the coast of Robunka. And you asked about my talents. I can swear in seven languages, much to my mother's chagrin."
Despite the fact that Jai didn't know where Robunka was either, he burst out laughing.
"Fair enough. I suppose multilingual swearing could be considered a talent of sorts."
Chanti said,
"Let's play a game. I share something, and then you reciprocate."
Jai considered the offer. "I'll play. What does your name mean?" She smiled.
"What you ask is no secret. I'll give you this information for free. Chanti Parthena Lord means peaceful maiden of highest honor."
When she saw his surprise, she added,
"Yes, it is a lot to live up to. Sometimes I wish my parents had named me something with lower expectations."
"Still," Jai said, "it suits you." She looked at him slyly.
"Really?
Well, maybe not the peaceful part, considering your talent with fire root.
Hey!
He ignored her protest. But you are certainly a maiden, and given your focus on freeing slaves, I'd say you are of the highest honour. She blinked.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Do I get to ask another question?
No. This is my game, so I decide the rules. First, choose a tier. Any of them. I will tell you its story.
She dismounted and walked beside him, leading her mare. Jai studied her face, those 17 tiers. Once he would have thought each tier contained an action-packed tale of her prowess in battle, but after last night he knew they were full of sadness, like real tears darkening on her cheeks. Still, the game was a wonderful excuse to examine her smooth red skin, the faint lines in her forehead, the curves of her nose, her jaw, her lips.
"The one beneath your right eye," he said. "I have many tears. Show me."
She shifted closer. Jai's skin grew warmer, despite the relatively cool night air. Shanti's eyes were blue and round in the typical Terran manner, but in the moment when her eyes blinked open, there was a flash of silver around the edges that he could see, even in the dark. Every time he looked at this woman, he seemed to notice something new, something more spectacular about her. He reached out a hand, extending a shaking finger, and touched the spot he was referring to. The black tear etched on her face was smooth, flawless, a work of art.
"Like you," he wanted to say. "My first tear," Shanti said,
and he retracted his hand.
"For my sister, Aaliyah."
"I'm sorry, I didn't mean to." She cut him off.
"It's fine. I speak of my tears freely. They are my best and worst memories. Those stories I hold nearest to my heart.
Still, I'm sorry you lost her." Shanti nodded her thanks.
"My mother was a slave," she started.
Jai cocked his head to the side, having not expected her story to start that way, so similar to his own.
"It's true. My father, too. Aaliyah and I were marked as slaves the moment we were old enough."
10 years old," Jai said. "It was the same for the children born in Garadia. They all became slaves on their 10th name day. He had personally taken them to Fenir for the ceremony. Only the knowledge that he would return their free will upon returning to Garadia allowed him to suffer through it. But still, seeing their eyes turn black, that stiff expression falling over their young faces, it broke his heart every time.
"Yes, I was 10 when I was made a slave. My sister, too, though she was 2 years older than me.
How are you here? How are you free?" If she knew a way for slaves to gain their minds back, he longed to hear it. By sunset, every man, woman, and child in his group could truly have their freedom, not just the temporary reprieve he'd granted them.
Shanti shook her head. "I don't really know. Our master was not a kind man. We were naught but dogs to him, working us from dawn until the dark of night, until we collapsed into bed. When I was 12 and Aaliyah was 14, our master finally saw my sister."
Jai frowned.
"What do you mean?"
Shanti pursed her lips momentarily, but then continued.
"As more than a Terran dog. As a woman. She was already flowered, and growing more beautiful by the day. Everything's foggy, like I was living in a world of smoke, but I can still remember Aaliyah's beauty. It was like a light in a storm."
Jai wasn't certain he wanted to hear the rest, but he didn't interrupt.
"Our master tried to take Aaliyah to his bed. He commanded her. And then something impossible happened."
"What?" Jai was vaguely aware that they had both stopped walking, the rest of the people passing by on either side, some of them glancing in their direction before continuing on.
"My father intervened."
She paused, allowing Jai to consider her words.
"But that's impossible."
"Yes.
He was a slave. He shouldn't have been able to do anything but follow the commands of his master. Just as it's impossible that your people can make their own decisions."
"No, that's different. As their appointed master, I gave them free will. They are still slaves, just following my command rather than Vinhosa's.
True. But my father broke the chain somehow.
She motioned to her own neck.
His slave mark vanished.
He threw himself at our master, trying to protect Aaliyah. My father killed him, Jai, with his bare hands. I watched him as he squeezed the life out of that horrible man.
I don't know what to say.
Jai pictured all of the slaves across the realm rising up to fight their masters. The thought made him want to unleash a roar of excitement.
There's nothing to say. It happened. The only trouble was that our master was very rich and had an army of guards. They caught my father. They made him watch while they slit Aaliyah's throat. Then they slit his, too.
Jai's heart was pounding in his head, and a fist-sized knot had become lodged in his chest. Shanti pointed to one of the tears beneath her other eye.
This one is for my father. My second tear.
Jai felt real tears welling up.
I'm sorry. Me too. He was a good man. Have you heard of the Terran virtues?
He nodded. Jai's mother had taught them to him as a child. There were seven of them. Purity, selflessness, faith, generosity, courage, perseverance. The last one escaped his memory.
And patience, Shanti said.
I always struggled the most with that one.
But my father didn't. He was a seven.
Jai remembered what his mother told him about the Terrans, how they strove to master each of the virtues in order to become closer to their god, absence.
So he was some kind of a holy man?
She shook her head.
Not a priest, no. He could have been, but he chose to remain a farmer. Until we were taken.
Gods!
I wish I could have met him.
And your mother? Has she passed over into the void, too? She shook her head.
She has no tear. Not yet. She has a new master, though. They separated us. She now works for Hosa himself, else I would have rescued her years ago.
Jai contemplated the many times he'd been to Hosa's lavish residence. Had he ever seen a woman that resembled Shanti? He didn't think so. He would have surely remembered a woman as beautiful as that.
I would take your pain if I could, Jai said, his own words surprising him.
And yet he believed them. He desperately wanted to erase those tears from her skin, turn back time, save her family,
and my own. Thank you. You are kind.
But what about you? I still don't understand.
Like I said, neither do I. It was like my father. I can't explain it. After I lost Aaliyah and my father, after my mother was taken away, I felt different. Still numb, but not from the chains marked around my neck. From loss. From pain. I felt human again. And then one day I woke up and the slave mark was gone.
She stopped abruptly, biting her lip.
What? Nothing.
He sensed there was something unsaid, just resting on the tip of her tongue.
It vanished.
She continued, picking up where she left off.
I ran away from my new master and never looked back. Fate brought me to Sonica, and then to the rest of the Tears. They are my family now. Just like these people are yours.
Jai was about to respond when someone shouted across the terrain. A small shadowy form raced across the dustlands, his feet churning so fast they were a blur.
Jig, what is it? Jai asked, steadying the boy with two hands on his shoulders when he skidded to a stop.
I found something big, he said.
What?
A hole. A massive hole. I almost fell into it.
Oh, gods, Jai thought, a similar gaping hole opening up in his stomach.
Jai and Shanti had to push through a thick knot of people surrounding the hole. Sonica and several of the other rebels had already arrived on the scene, peering down the dark shaft with narrowed eyes. Jai said, "Does it look fresh?" Once he got within a step of the round void, he leaned over and looked into it.
The chasm went straight down, but then seemed to angle on a more horizontal underground path. He knew only one thing that could make a hole that big. Sonika inspected the edge of the hole, rubbing the crusted dirt between her fingers, wincing in pain. "The red Pison's slime is not yet dry," she said. "It's still poisonous." In other words, yes, it was fresh. The tips of her fingers were already red and inflamed from touching the slime, which, though painful when touched by human skin, was primarily used by the Pison to mark its territory from other predators. Jai noticed a large section of dried snakeskin dangling from the far side of the hole, fluttering in the wind.
"There's another hole over here,"
someone shouted in the crowd.
"And here,"
a third said. More and more discoveries of holes were announced, and then,
"A skin! I found the skin!"
They moved in the direction of the final call. When they came upon a group of people pointing and gawking at a tangled mess of dried red and black snakeskin, Jai's heart sank even further. The skin was impossibly long. Even 100 men lying end to end would not stretch as far. "We have to move," Jai said. It was known that after coming out of hibernation, the first thing a red would do was shed its skin. The second thing it would do was hunt. He'd never seen a red Pison, though he had seen their burrows before. The best bet was to turn around and go the other way. Unfortunately, they couldn't go back.
"Not necessarily," Sonika said.
"They travel fast. This snake could be 1,000 leagues away by now." "Or right under our feet," Jai said.
"No,"
Shanti said, shaking her head. "If it was under our feet, we would feel it. The earth would rumble."
"I hear it,"
a small voice said. Jai noticed that Jig had pressed his ear to the earth, listening intently. His eyes were wide.
"Listen."
Immediately, the tears and Jai did the same, as well as many of the people gathered around. Though it was faint, the slight tremor was unmistakable. Something was moving beneath the ground. Something big. Murmurs of fear coursed through the crowd like the current from a lightning strike. Sonika was on her feet in an instant.
"Move!"
she shouted. She leapt back on her horse and swooped her hand in the direction of the red cliffs, which resembled dark spikes in the distance. The people needed no further urging, shouldering their packs, grabbing the children's hands, and fleeing north. The mounted black tears spread out amongst the people, shouting commands and warning them to avoid the holes. Jai snatched Jig's hand and took off, practically pulling the boy off his feet.
"Hurry,"
he said. The rumble grew stronger until Jai could feel it as he ran. He was forced to skid to a stop when a dark void opened up in front of him. For a moment, he thought he'd halted his momentum too late, his foot slipping over the edge, but then he fell back, Jig collapsing on top of him. Cursing, he scrambled to his feet and cut a wide path around the hole, still dragging Jig behind him. The ground shifted, throwing him off balance. He jabbed his hand down to the dirt to keep from falling, but the sudden jerk made Jig trip. As the boy tumbled, his hand ripped out of Jai's grasp. It saved both their lives. Just where they would have been had they continued running in a straight line, the earth exploded upwards, followed by an enormous line of rubbery flesh, painted in alternating lines of red and black. Jai and Jig kicked backwards in tandem, staring in horror as the monstrous beast seemed to take an eternity to fully emerge from the newly formed hole, its body the length of 100 men, as wide around as one of the great pillars of Fenia. Thick slime spewed from its skin, splattering Jai's face, arms, and chest as he threw his body across Jig. Jai howled at the pain from the slime, which was like a dozen flames being shoved into his skin. Gritting his teeth, he rolled, still keeping Jig between him and the Pison, which flew through the air, opening its giant maw and swallowing several people whole as it plunged back into the earth, opening up a new hole like a knife slicing through butter. "My people are dying." In the dark, it was hard to recognize the victims, but he'd spotted Carp, the friendly barrel-sized man who'd vouched for him back at Garadia when the Black Tears wanted to kill him. He'd seen the man's mouth gaped open in terror, heard his last cry before the monster took him. "Oh, gods! What void have I led them to?"
"No!"
Jai screamed, fighting off the wave of sorrow that threatened to pull him under, to suffocate him. It wasn't the time to mourn those lost, not when so many were still alive, rushing in droves through the dark, dodging holes and... Screams rent the night as the Paizan emerged once more, this time farther away from Jai. Those unfortunate enough to be directly beneath the snake were impaled on its teeth, swallowed whole or thrown roughly aside like rag dolls. Gardner, Hominy, Nash, Jai rattled off in his head. There was one of the dreadnoughters, too, Lonish, who'd always been one of the best miners working in Garadia. There were dozens more, as this time the snake landed with a thump on the hard-packed dirt, its long tail snapping as it slithered from side to side, hissing and biting anyone in its path. "Jig," Jai said. "Stay here, right next to its hole." Jig clung to his neck, tears streaking his cheeks.
"Don't leave me," he cried.
Jai clamped his hands on either side of the boy's face. "Do you trust me?" Jig nodded between Jai's hands. Jai had once heard that a red Paizan wouldn't dig a new hole directly beside an existing one, because then its tunnels would grow unstable. "Stay here. I have to help the others. Don't move. It's safest directly beside the burrow. Do you understand?" The boy nodded again. Jai clambered to his feet, praying that what he'd heard was true, and he wasn't sentencing the boy to death. All around him were bodies. Some were injured, groaning and writhing in pain. Others weren't moving. Others were whimpering, too afraid to move, hoping the Paizan would simply pass them by. Ahead, the snake slapped one of the black tears from her horse with its barbed tail. The way her body flopped lifelessly, Jai could tell she was dead before she hit the ground. Though he hated himself for thinking it, in his mind he said, "Please don't be Sonic a horse shanty. Please, please, please." The way the other women looked to Sonica, Jai already knew she was the heart and soul of the tears. They needed her. And Shanti? Jai didn't know what she was to him yet, only that he'd felt connected to her from the moment he met her. Perhaps his subconscious had known they both had parents who were slaves. With a loud hiss, the Paizan vanished, diving into one of its burrows, its deadly tail scraping behind it. Nearby, a horse whinnied in fright as the ground continued to shake. Jai called out, racing for the rider. It was Sonica, who was gathering the rest of her surviving tears to her. "We have to fight it," she said. "Wound it, or kill it. It's the only way." Jai knew she was right. Given its size, he was certain the Paizan could devour them all and still be hungry. It was known that one of the reasons red Paizans were so rarely seen was that they hibernated for years at a time, only coming out to hunt when their slow-digesting bodies had used up all of its resources. Then they would emerge from their burrows and feast until sated, before returning to hibernation once more. "What do we do?" Jai asked. Though he'd never used it to fight, Jai pulled his knife from its sheath, gripping it with white knuckles. "Go for its eyes. Its throat," Sonica said. Her horse reared up when there was a fresh rumble, the ground undulating beneath them. "Get ready." For a moment, his eyes met Shanti's, which were full of steel, like she'd become a completely different woman to the one he sat atop the cliffs with. He knew to survive, he'd have to become a completely different man, the one trained for combat. "For them," he thought. "I can do it for them." The snake emerged, scattering Jai's people like dominoes swept off a table by a child's hand.
"Go!"
Sonica roared, spurring her horse forward. Jai took off, quickly falling back from the riders, but refusing to give up, leaping over bodies and swerving around those fleeing the beast. The horses pulled to a stop and their riders attacked, throwing knives and shooting arrows. The minuscule weapons bounced off of the Paizan's hard scales as it reared up, its head too high for any of them to reach with their projectiles. Jai's knife suddenly felt like a toy against such raw power. "What am I doing?" he thought. But then he saw several of his people, Jahi and Manish and Job, hunkering next to one of the burrows. "I'm protecting them," he thought, "and I will give my life if necessary." Though he'd always known he would die for them, the realization was like a splash of cold water across his face. He reached Shanti and shouted up to her, "It's not working!" She had something in her hand, a wrapped package tied with twine.
"Remember what I did to Garadia?" she asked. "If we can get close enough to light this and throw it in its face."
Jai remembered the power of the fire root. He also knew there was no way they'd be able to light it and throw the weapon fast enough to land a direct hit. But they had to try.
"I'll light it," he said.
Jai searched his pockets for his flint, and then used the blade of his knife to get a spark going, but the thread dangling from the package wouldn't seem to light. The snake hissed loudly, and Jai fumbled the flint, dropping it in the dirt. Frantically, he searched the ground, his fingers finally locating it. When he stood up, the snake was charging right for them, rearing up and preparing to strike.
"Hurry!"
Shanti cried. More sparks, several of them charring the thread, which burst into flame, travelling quickly toward the parcel. The snake flung its head down at them, fangs snapping. With a shout, Shanti launched the package.
Boom!
There was a flash of light, and the snake recoiled, snapping its head from side to side. It let out a hiss and dove into the ground, only to re-emerge a moment later, slightly further away. Shanti already had another fire root package in her hands.
"We have to get closer. Blind it."
But there was something in Jai's memory, a flash of thought and then an idea.
"Give it to me," he said,
as the giant snake slithered closer. Above them, the Paizon hissed, preparing to strike once more. When Shanti hesitated, he said,
"Hurry!"
She handed him the parcel. "Here goes nothing," Jai thought. And then he charged the Paizon just as it arched its back and struck. Horses and people screamed as the Paizon smashed its jaws into the earth, snapping viciously. Its scales were so close to Jai that he could see his reflection in their glossy, slime-sheathed surface. With a cry, he threw himself onto the snake's flesh, driving his knife in with one hand while clutching Shanti's parcel of fire root with the other. As the snake bucked and writhed, acid burned through his clothes, scorching his skin, but he refused to let go, pushing off with his feet. The sticky, scaly skin made the snake's body easy enough to climb, though the pain was so fierce Jai grew dizzy. With each step upward, he slammed his knife between the scales, scraping his body a little higher. And then the slime was gone. He'd reached the Paizon's head, which was covered with pure red scales with none of the sticky excretion. Still, his entire body was coated in the poison, and he felt as if he'd been thrust into a fire. His vision spun, and he feared he might pass out, but he managed to hang on to consciousness by focusing on gripping the knife. Wind whipped all around him as the world flew past, the snake slithering across the terrain with even greater speed than before. Jai held on with everything he had, but his grip was slippery with sweat and slime, each and every nerve ending screaming with pain. One finger slid off.
"No,"
he growled, pushing off with his feet and regaining his full grip. If he could just get over the crest of the beast's skull. The Paizon dove downward, and it was all Jai could do not to be thrown off, his body rattling, his teeth clacking against each other as the snake travelled underground through darkness. The top of the tunnel scraped against Jai's head, dirt spilling all around him, threatening to fill his mouth, his nose. And then they were above ground again, the Paizon shooting into the air and landing with a thunderous smack. Jai had almost nothing left to give, his fingers stiff and sore from gripping the knife, his arm and shoulder numb from the climb and clinging for dear life. With a final kick, Jai pushed himself up and over the Paizon's head, tumbling directly onto its face, sucked downward by gravity. One of its red eyes swept past, and he had the presence of mind to swipe at it with his knife missing, only managing to scratch the scale just under it. Still he fell, bouncing over its slit-like nose, and then he was airborne. Fangs as tall as himself gaped apart, ready to snap him in two, surrounding a maw so black and empty it was as if he stared into the void itself. If this would be his last act, he would make it a great one, one that might save his people. He threw the fire root parcel. The Paizon snapped at him, and he slammed off the broadside of one of its long incisors, tumbling away into a backflip. He landed in the dust, flat on his stomach, the impact pushing all of the air from his lungs with a whoosh. He rolled over, gasping for breath, clutching at his abdomen as if he could coax the air back into his chest. Above him, the red moon smiled while the green moon stared with an unblinking eye. The Pison swayed, readying for a final strike. A muffled boom split the night, and the Pison split in two, its enormous head and neck flopping forward, while the rest of it tumbled sidelong. Dark flesh and red scales and clear liquid erupted like a geyser, spraying Jai and the area around him as the Pison's head landed nearby, its twin black eyes boring through him. Its maw released a final snap, the fangs so close that he could feel the air from their movement, and then the beast went still. The rest of the snake continued to squirm and writhe, as if still alive, but blind and incapable of attacking. Yet, by some instinct, it flopped and slithered and rolled until it found one of its burrows, disappearing underground. Air rushed back into Jai's lungs, and for a while he just sucked at the breeze, watching the golden stars glitter, red stars fly past, and green stars explode in the black sky. Though he felt like a fried side of bacon, somehow, by the will of the gods, he was still alive.
24. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhea Loren. Rhea stood, looking down from the highest tower in the castle, gazing across the Bay of Bounty, where her enemies were preparing for war. But her thoughts were elsewhere, taking her back to that day in the Furium, watching the young girls train to be warriors of Wrath, when the Fury had revealed the truth about the Western Oracle and Shae Aris. Rhea was thinking about lies. She had been lied to her entire life. In fact, all the people of the Western Kingdom had been deceived. The scary thing was, the lie had come before any of them were born, passed down from generation to generation. And why? Because her great-great-grandfather's father had decided his most prized warrior, his original Fury, was an enemy to Wrath. He'd made her into the Western Oracle, Rhea realized. In distancing himself from her, he'd created her legend. All because of some prophecies she'd made about the four kingdoms being ripped apart by war, and the death of eight rulers and other nonsense that a common fortune-teller could make up. Then again, rulers were dying. Wrath, my own father, was killed before my very eyes by a monster. Coincidence. Had to be. And yet, Rhea couldn't get the rest of what the Fury had told her out of her head. How the three Furies discovered an old scroll within a hidden chamber in the Furium. How it contained symbols and a map. How several of the symbols matched known sin marks, including the one discovered on Shae Aris's foot. How the map showed the locations of other hidden documents, books. The Western Oracle's legacy, or so they thought. There was the mention of peace in the Four Kingdoms, alliances between rulers, the end of war. That cannot happen, Rhea had said. No, it cannot, the Fury had agreed. At least they were in agreement on that point, Rhea mused now. She didn't want peace. She wanted a righteous war to wipe out the barbarians to the south, the witches to the east, the godless citizens of the north. She needed her people to believe they were Wrath's warriors, and if the Western Oracle was suddenly exposed as a Fury, everything would be questioned, including her own devotion to Wrath. After all, she was the queen now, connected to the Furia as none other was. And the girl, Shae Aris. Her mark was important somehow, or so the Furies believed, which was why they'd taken such drastic measures to get her away from Night's End alive, to study her. Based on the Oracle's drawing on the scroll they had found, the Furies believed she was the key, both literally and figuratively, to all of the others who bore marks. To Rhea, this was a powerful notion, because many of the marked were her sworn enemies, the Ice Lord in the north, Beyond Stonesledge, the Ironmarked, in the east, Fire Sands in Calip, the Slave Master in Fanes. If Grey's sister could be a weapon against them. She'd immediately sent Furia riders south,
to bring back news about the Fuhrer's discoveries, as well as the map. It was a fortnight later, and they had yet to return, a fact that troubled her greatly. How can a dead woman wield such immense power? She wondered. Though it annoyed her, it also intrigued her. Would she ever be able to maintain power even after she'd gone to her grave? The thought amused her, and she laughed. Ennis, who'd been standing silently beside her the entire time, said, "Do you find your enemy's naval fleet amusing, Your Highness?" Rhea didn't like his tone. Sarcastic. Condescending. More and more lately, that was how he sounded. A spark of anger burned through her, drying up her laughter, and she had to fight back the urge to push him off the wall. She forced a smile back onto her face. "Dear cousin, I don't believe I asked for your counsel." "Then why am I here, my queen? Why do you keep me on as your adviser when my words are wind, my counsel naught but dust under your feet?" It was a good question, a fair question, and it gave Rhea pause, for she didn't rightly know. Something swelled in her chest, a balloon of... Rhea suddenly felt short of breath, her heart beating too fast, her legs as rubbery as boiled chicken. Ennis's voice changed, growing less haughty with a note of concern, and he addressed her as a familiar. "Rhea, are you ill?" He reached out a hand to steady her. The balloon pressed against Rhea's lungs, and she couldn't breathe, couldn't breathe, couldn't... "I'm fine," she snapped, pulling away from Ennis, forcing a deep breath into her shrunken lungs. "Are you certain? Because you look rather pale, I'm certain. Do not question your queen, and do not call me Rhea again, unless you insert queen before it. Do I make myself clear?" Ennis frowned at her, his hand still hovering midway between them, but then he said, "Crystal, if there is nothing else you need, I will retire for the evening. We will all need to be fresh tomorrow." "As you wish, cousin," Rhea said. She pretended to ignore him, though she watched his every move out of the corner of her eye, until he was well and truly gone, disappearing down the staircase. She shot glares at the two Fuhrer who remained, as still as statues. "Leave me," she said. They obeyed without looking at her, and the moment they were gone too, Rhea collapsed to her knees, the tears welling up faster than she could blink them away, pouring down her cheeks. She choked on a sob, the moment of weakness making her cry harder. She felt like a crumpled doll thrown in a corner by a child who'd grown bored of it, moving on to newer and more appealing toys. Because she'd recognized that balloon in her chest for what it was. A feeling that had been lingering on the edges of her for days, maybe longer, perhaps since the moment Grey Aris had walked away from her, leaving her with a kindly old stranger who'd taken her in, made her soup, and cobbled her a beautiful pair of boots fit for a queen. She felt alone. And that was the answer to Ennis's question about why she kept him around. Because he was the only one left who vanquished the dragon inside her. He was her only true friend. And yet she was pushing him away, just like all the others. She hated this feeling, hated it as much as she hated her enemies, hated it as much as her own scarred reflection in the mirror. She dashed her tears away with the hem of her dress, pushed to her feet, snarled at the wall, kicking it with the heel of her beautiful boots, and flung a curse toward the north. "I am strong," she said. "I am not alone. I have myself, and that is all I need." "Wrath, I'm losing it," she thought, "talking to myself, kicking walls, crying like a baby." It was all this talk of war, she knew. All the preparation, all the strategizing, all the hustle and bustle with no real results. The waiting was the worst. Focus. She had to focus. She unfurled the message she'd received from the North earlier that week via Inkreed Stream. This time it wasn't from King Archer Garrick, but from his sister Anise, who'd declared herself Queen of the North, as her brother was unconscious and she'd come of age under Northern law.
Her cousin stated that she'd received Rhea's message of war, and that she wouldn't try to convince her otherwise. Anise went on to say that in the current situation, she considered Rhea and the West an ally, if only because they had a common enemy in her uncle, Lord Griswold, who was intent on destroying them both. Because of this, she had offered information, gathered by Queen Garrick's spies at Blackstone. The message was clear. Lord Griswold would attack Knight's End with his entire fleet on the morrow, at midday, under the watchful eye of the sun. Rhea crumpled the message in her fist, and then stuffed it in her bodice. She would use it as kindling in her hearth later. For she didn't need information from Anise, who was technically her cousin, the daughter of her deceased aunt, Sabria Loren Garrick. Long before she'd received the message from the north, she was ready for war, whenever it came. No, not ready. Starved. Yes, that was it. She was starved for war. And it seemed she would have her feast sooner than she expected. Her tears long vanquished, Rhea felt herself again, taking the stairs swiftly. Noon on the morrow couldn't come soon enough. Anise Garrick had not lied, which Rhea respected. Maybe her cousin didn't have to be an enemy after all. She knew it was a child's dream, but still she liked the thought. Queen cousins forming an alliance to take control of the Four Kingdoms. It had a certain romantic appeal to the girl she once was. Regardless, whatever came next would have to wait. As the sun approached its peak, Lord Griswold's ships set out across the Bay of Bounty, their sails unfurled like enormous grey wings, each stitched with the cracked but not broken shield of the north. An ugly sigil, in Rhea's estimation. She much preferred her own, the rearing stallion atop a cliff. It was more majestic, more royal. She loved the way the symbol sparkled on the full set of armour she was wearing. It spoke of battles past, of victory, of defeat, of a rightful claim to the realm. Beyond the first wave of enemy ships, hundreds more cast off from the northern shore into the bay, moving full wind ahead. Rhea had to admit they were an impressive sight as they charged across the shimmering waters. "Roth, be with us," Ennis said from beside her. Despite their brief altercation the previous day, he'd shown up at first light at her quarters. Utterly predictable, like the return of a misbehaving hound. In any case, Rhea didn't begrudge him his sense of honour, allowing him to follow her around like a love-starved puppy all morning. He was wearing light armour and a broadsword, but no shield. Rhea had the feeling he would offer himself as her shield if it came down to it. "Roth is with us," Rhea said. She turned to the summoner, who was on her other side, dressed in a plain grey frock made of sackcloth, despite the armour she'd had custom made for him. Unless it was well hidden, he wasn't wearing the armour. "Will Roth armour him?" Rhea wondered grimly. "Do I bear falsehood?" she asked the holy man. His expression was grim, but it wasn't a denial.
"Nay," he said, "you do not lie. Roth's fury shall be unleashed on our enemies this day."
Rhea glanced back, where her most violent pawn stood waiting, watching, garbed in blood-red armour. The fury looked ready to murder the world, and Rhea wondered whether the summoner meant fury or fury. Either course would work for her, so long as she won the day.
"See, cousin, we have nothing to fear."
Ennis didn't look as convinced. He laid a tender hand on her armoured shoulder, and this time she didn't shrug it off.
"There is still the opportunity for you to watch from the wall, or better yet, from the tower."
They'd already had this argument to death, and thus Rhea didn't hesitate with her response.
"No. But I will not have my men,"
she glanced at the Fury, who was standing behind her,
"and women, risk that which I am not willing to risk myself."
It was a quote from the message stream she'd received from Cousin Anise, one she particularly liked. Though Rhea wore her image as righteous queen like a second set of armour, that wasn't the real reason she wanted to be in the midst of the battle.
"No, I want to feel Roth's power around me, witness it from touching distance. I want to feel alive again, bursting with something beyond this world.
Rhea couldn't explain it exactly, only that the thought of such raw power at her disposal was like an addiction, a drug she had to have. And she would have it. And it was better than being alone atop the tower. As usual, Ennis wasn't displaced so easily.
"I know you trust this man."
He nodded at the summoner, who didn't seem to care that he was being talked about without his inclusion.
"But you have no evidence of what he claims to be able to do."
It was true. Twice Ennis had tried to goad the man into summoning something, anything. And twice the man had shrugged it off, saying Roth did not perform like some festival entertainer. For all she knew, the summoner could be a very effective fraud, and they were all about to die.
"So be it," Rhea thought.
She wasn't afraid of death, not any more. Not when she'd stared into the blade of Roth and emerged forged by steel and fire.
"If I die today, let it be a bloody death."
But she didn't think she would die, at least not on this day, and she was willing to take the risk for what the outcast said he could offer. And anyway, it wasn't as if they hadn't taken precautions. They'd sought out the best divers in the kingdom, who had been busy for a fortnight, planting spiked metal balls deep under the waters of the bay, stringing them together with long iron chains. They'd recruited thousands of seaworthy men and women, who now filled their ships to overflowing, prepared to give their lives for Roth's righteous cause. In return, Rhea had promised them a place in the seventh heaven. Every blacksmith in the realm had been contracted to build armor and swords and other weaponry to outfit her growing army. Thousands of carpenters had flocked to the castle, practically begging to assist in the war effort, creating contraptions that could fling almost anything nearly halfway across the bay. Finally, Rhea had charged the Furia, save for the 70 who accompanied her as her personal guard, with manning the shores as the last stand. If all else failed, she would have her finest warriors fight in close combat to the bitter end. And if, after all that, her kingdom was taken, then she would die in peace. She almost laughed at her thoughts.
Peace? There will be no peace, so long as my enemies are alive.
"I am going with the summoner," Rhea said. "But you are not chained to me, cousin.
You may cower behind the walls like a simpering child if you wish. I will not hold it against you, I swear it."
She knew it wasn't a real option, but she offered it simply because she enjoyed seeing Ennis's loyalty spring to the surface each time it was called into question.
"Your Highness, I would ride with you to the gates of the first heaven and back if you asked me to."
"Then ride now," she said, stepping onto the gangplank. The Furia, who were already on board, lined the edges of the finest ship in the fleet, Roth's chosen, looking outward. Several seamen who had been hand-selected to sail the vessel pretended not to look at the Queen, but Rhea felt their gazes flitting on her and away, restless and nervous and full of anticipation. Behind her, Ennis followed, along with the summoner and the Fury. The sun shone brightly, far too cheerful for a battle. As the men readied the ship for cast-off, tossing lines across the decks and handling the sails, Rhea watched the rest of her fleet take form. The moment the Northerners had set sail, anchors had been raised, and dozens of ships with various Roth-inspired names had responded, setting out from the royal docks. Rhea could make out seamen scuttling like ants across the decks, steel glinting in the sun. The lead Northern vessels were fast approaching the center of the bay. A volley of arrows shot out, and Rhea held her breath as her shipborne soldiers closed ranks and raised shields. One man was hit, tumbling overboard, but most of the arrows deflected away harmlessly. Rhea found herself turning back toward the western shores, waiting, waiting. Nothing happened.
"Why are they delaying? The Northerners are in range."
As if in response to her question, fireballs roared through the air, enormous boulders soaked in torch oil flung from massive catapults. She counted them as they flew. 7, one for each of the heavens, just as she had instructed. She knew her soldiers would already be loading the machinery for another volley, even before the first shots had landed. Everyone on her ship watched the fiery projectiles soar through the air. They arced and then began their downward descent. Three splashed into the water, their aim miscalculated. Two hit enemy sails, ripping through the thick canvas, which was splashed with oil and caught